I got the signal to wait just a moment, so I'll just welcome everyone back. Having a good time? I haven't been announcing most of the door prizes, but I am continuing to give away. I think I've given away all the dinner gift certificates for those of you that are eating out on the town tonight, and I tried to find people on a budget to give them to. But there are still quite a few DVDs which will be given away over the next day or two. If you have not won a door prize, you can alert me to that fact, but I think we have enough door prizes so that everyone's a winner. And I also wanted to thank the people from the last session for doing running such a tight ship and staying on schedule, but also giving a great presentation. During the lunch, there were so many great connections being made with Bill Birch and other people, and Alan Stark from Film Technology said, well, you know, my lab did all of the work and post-production with on the Lowell Thomas TV series, so we have correspondence and documentation too, and there are all kinds of other things serendipitous that I know. I forgot to recognize Bill Murphy and Bill O'Farrell, who know a lot about this movie tone newsreel story, so it's a great thing, which obviously is going to have a long life. So just want to double check, are we okay with audio video for this? And that's a thumbs up, James? Yes, okay, just wanted to be safe. This is going to be a great panel too. In other news, our conception of newsreel is going to be quite different. Everything on this panel has some relation to newsreel or someone who worked in the news business, but the films are kind of alternate to what we're used to thinking of. And first up, with a really short and sweet and I think quite remarkable find, is Sean Savage from NYU's Moving Image Archiving Preservation Program, who's going to tell us about something they found in Maine at Northeast Historic Film.
Thank you. So there's really two stories to my presentation. As you'll see in the program, there's the Madison newsreel and the story of the Bureau of Commercial Economics. And we're going to kind of take them one at a time and see how they converge, and they do in a very curious way. The Madison newsreel is a 250-foot nitrate reel that was donated to Northeast Historic Film in February of 2001. It was found in a barn in Bristol, Maine, about 80 miles from the subject of the film, which is the town of Madison. Northeast Historic Film recognized that it was of regional significance, and they made a new internegative in print, which we will be seeing in a few minutes, care of Cineric. But they still didn't know what to make of it, content-wise, and you'll see why. I think it's best to come into it cold and experience it, and then we're even going to look at it a second time, where I'll sort of explain what I've learned about it. So I was an intern at Northeast Historic Film last summer, and this sort of came up towards the end of my time there, and decided to go with it because it's the kind of thing that only an intern has time to do. So I think we're going to look at it now, and it's about as mysterious as the bits and pieces from last night. So this is the Madison newsreel. So if we could get the PowerPoint on, there's some things to show you. So one of the most striking things, of course, about that is the animated eyeball logo. And for years, NHS staff just referred to the film as The Eye Beholds. That's what they knew about it. And no one had really had time to look into it anymore. So some of you may have heard of the Bureau of Commercial Economics. They were a silent-era distributor of industrial films, founded in 1913, and they existed for about 20 years. So in addition to trying to decipher this film, I'm also doing a history of the Bureau, and the evidence is pretty scattered as far as their existence, and that's actually the focus of my thesis at NYU. So if we can, we'll put the Madison newsreel aside for a second and talk about the Bureau of Commercial Economics. Do I need to do anything to get this up there? Okay. Okay, we've seen all that. So the Bureau was co-founded in 1913 by Francis Hawley, who was an engineer for the Northern Pacific and Canadian Pacific Railways, and educator and economist Anita Maris Boggs. They're both pictured there. And they were both very wealthy, and this was a philanthropic organization that was non-governmental, and them and their distinguished colleagues financed the Bureau. And Hawley, biography, the chronology of Hawley's life is a little spotty. I haven't been able to find an obituary of him, but apparently when he was around 30, he was blinded as an adult for about 10 years and then had his sight restored through some sort of miracle operation. And I imagine that's where the eye beholds comes from. So the original idea was to provide vocational training to young men using motion pictures. Again, this is 1913, 1914. And films of industrial processes were provided by various manufacturers, and they were shown not just to those looking for a trade, but to anyone who cared to see them. And with these projector trucks that the Bureau had built, they literally rolled into city parks and public squares and playgrounds and showed the films for free outdoors. And so I have other photographs that I'm not going to show, but where there's a whole sea of people in this tiny little screen, and they claimed audiences of thousands of people. So an incentive for sponsors to donate films to the Bureau was, of course, the publicity benefit. But in addition to these early industrial films, reels of national parks and other scenics were also shown, and eventually war propaganda films. Despite the implication of their name, the Bureau was not a government agency. And I get the sense that some of this confusion may have been intentional, and they wanted to sort of play it both ways, there being benefits to being private and, you know, presumably federal. Two benefits of being a private institution was that they could show films that included trademarks and trade names of the manufacturers who submitted films, and it also freed them to exchange films with other countries. So over their two decades of existence, they exchanged films with over 50 different countries. There's one of their trucks there. In addition to these projector trucks, they also distributed films using different universities as their circulation hubs. And actually one of the films that they circulated was An American in the Making, which we will see later tonight, although I'm sure they weren't an exclusive distributor of that one. So if the Bureau had been a government agency, it would probably make my job a lot easier as far as research goes, because for being around 20 years, I'm sure they had a considerable amount of internal documents, but I haven't been able to locate a centralized repository. And what I have found is tends to be in special collections of universities, including film catalogs, pamphlets, and correspondence. So it's all been pretty scattered. So now we come back to the Madison newsreel, and what possible affiliation could there really be between these two things? I'm pretty convinced that it's a red herring, that whoever assembled this Madison newsreel put the logo in because it was on hand and sort of lended some authenticity to the piece. I mean, the Bureau would presumably put the logo on the heads of the programs that they showed, but in this case, it's the second shot, which doesn't make any sense. And but interestingly, this is the only surviving example of the logo that I've found so far. Maybe someone can tell me different. So while the Bureau would show films of civil life of different communities, in this case, there's so much inside humor going on that any sense of it made to an outsider really cannot be made. So I tried to make some sense of that. And I sent a video copy to the president of the Madison Historical Society. They have one there, and he confirmed the suspicion that none of the footage is from Madison. None of that looks anything like Madison. However, the people named were, in fact, citizens of Madison at the time, but those pictured on screen aren't them. So it's all appropriated, and I think some or most of it comes from a Bureau of Economics program. And it seems to only be drawing from a few different sources. So I made a trip to Madison to the Historical Society and wanted to go through their newspapers. I figured in a town as small as this, where what people had for dinner ended up in the newspaper, that if a film was, you know, made about the community, that surely a mention of it would have made it into the paper. And again, this is a 35-millimeter nitrate. They did have a movie house, and I don't know how else it could have been shown around the time. The date codes on the film, some of the shots are 1917, 1918, but this could have been assembled any time in the 20s or 30s even. So I was trying to figure out how to focus the newspapers I looked at. It was a weekly newspaper, mercifully, but still, that's 20-plus years of papers to look at. So the cue I took, and I'm still not sure it's the right one, but it sort of worked out, was the reference to the eclipse in the film. There were two solar eclipses in this rough period of January 1925 and August 1932, and eclipses that had high visibility in the Northeast. So I sort of took that and kind of looked at newspapers 6 months on either side of those dates and have not been able to find any reference to the film, but a lot of sort of anecdotal, biographical information about some of the people in the film. And so I think it can help me date it a little more precisely, and I'm thinking around 1932. So if we can run it again, I'll tell you why I came to that conclusion. So the first person we're going to see, or not really him, but is the Reverend Charles Sinden. And whether or not he was really a one-armed man, I have no way of knowing, but that would be a pretty tasteless joke if that were the case. And you can also notice in this shot the General Motors Sampson tractor, which was introduced in 1917, which I don't think would be an industrial film, because if you lose your arm using their tractor, that's not. So you have to look really closely, but that sign is the dispersing office of the Bureau of War Risk Insurance. So I think these might be widows collecting their checks, although they look too happy. It might be staged just to get that shot. Ernest H. Ward was a developer, and he did have a block that was kind of considered his because he owned all the property on it. And in 1932, he bought a building with the intention of rebuilding it as the First National store. Carol Danforth was just a kid and didn't graduate from high school until 1933. I was hoping to find some story of a rambunctious kid climbing a tree and getting stuck or something, and that's what this reference is about, but didn't find anything like that. I haven't been able to make sense of this shot. I think it might be from the Bureau of War Risk Insurance film as well, just based on tinting and edge markings. And the Bureau of Commercial Economics distributed 100 prints of this war risk insurance film, which is called Uncle Sam Insurance Agent. Reverend E.C. Evans was, in fact, on a month-long vacation to Prince Edward Island in August of 1932, which was the month of the eclipse. And Tom, with just a first name, I wasn't able to find anything about him. But Starks is another town. I think the three towns mentioned in this film are in about a 50-mile radius of one another. And so with this, I was trying to figure out what the significance of the figure $40 billion was in the late teens and figured it had to do something with the war. And it was significant for three reasons. It was the estimated amount of what it would cost the U.S. to enter and participate in the war for 2 years. It was also the amount that Britain was demanding from Germany as reparations after the war. But what I think it is, in 1920, it was the amount that the Bureau of War Risk Insurance had paid out on behalf of American forces. So, again, I think this is probably from Uncle Sam Insurance Agent, which is a Treasury Department film, which is at the National Archives. And on Monday, I'm going to go look at it and confirm that. I'm sorry, I wasn't able to do that before. And then this is great, Mark Spear. I like this visual pun. You've got a disinterested guy looking, and then the rotating Earth, which presumably is the eclipse that he's looking at. So a little more dirt on Mark Spear. He's as much of a mystery as he appears in those 2 seconds. People at the Historical Society had different ideas about who he was. One thought he was a photographer, which may make his reputation as an eclipse enthusiast, you know, that connection could be made. Another thought he was a milk inspector. I found a story in the paper citing an M.M. Spear as Justice of the Peace. In 1937, Mark M. Spear was badly burned in a shop when a gas can exploded, and we don't know what the nature of his work was. And in 1934, Mark Spear was being sued for breach of promise by a New York woman named Nellie Bly. So, so that's the Madison Newsreel, and I guess I'll give a fuller report on the Bureau of Commercial Economics next time. Thanks.